Author Darren Wong's new novel, his first, is called The Hidden Light of Northern Fires. It offers a fresh take on the American Civil War. Darren is also co-founder of the Decatur Book Festival, and that's where his new book was launched. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So almost as interesting as the actual story in the novel is the story of how this novel came to be. Now, did you know about this history before you found out you were living in that house?
No. So we moved into this house when I was 5 years old. So, I mean, the whole bizarre history didn't even, you know, as a five-year-old, it doesn't really intrude into your mindset. And, you know, parts of it kind of were presented to us, but it didn't fit together. And, you know, some of it was wives' tales and crazy and stuff like that. So kind of discovering what was true and what was not was a lot of the fun.
So you ended up in is this town that you write about is Townline, New York.
Yeah.
And the interesting tidbit about it is that it was the only town. It's just outside Buffalo, right?
Yes.
It's the only town north of the Mason-Dixon line that seceded.
Yes.
And interestingly enough, did not rejoin the Union until like the 1940s?
1946, January 1946, to be precise.
So you pitched this for years to authors to have them write it as a book.
Yeah, I mean, because somebody ought to, right?
So give me an example of how you pitched them.
Well, if you're out drinking with authors or something like
which
that,
which I'm sure you've done
as I would often do, because with the festival, and you know, these stories would come up, you know, and particularly down here in the South, of bizarre Southern, you know, the granddad or great great granddad buried the silver in the backyard kind of
right.
stories, and I would say, you want a real Southern story? How about this? You know, my town, 15 miles from the Canadian border, seceded from the Union, and my house was on the Underground Railroad. You should write that. And they go, and then I would do.
And you could never convince anyone to write that story.
No, you can't convince anybody to write a story. Everybody has a, you know, it's not hard to come up with a good story to write. It's the work of spending a couple of years of your life on it. That's the hard part.
So you, and before that, you had been a writer, but you'd written short stories and shorter pieces. You had never written a full length book.
Yeah. Well, I hadn't even really taken on fiction at all. I'd written pieces for, you know, journalist pieces, reviews and stuff like that, but I'd never really taken on a novel.
So you described it to the AJC as that you had to teach yourself how to write in order to do this book.
Yeah, well, you know, how to write a good sentence, you know? It's not easy to put on it to, you know. To get the rhythm and the complexity of a good sentence and have different things going on, and you know if you pay attention to those things, it's not, you know, hopefully as a reader you never notice it, but as a writer you want to get it right.
So how do you teach yourself to write a novel? I mean, how does one do that? I mean, you've been reading, assuming, your whole life. So what else do you need to do?
Well, you know, one perfect example is the main character, Mary Willis, who's running this Underground Railroad station, right?
Yeah.
You know, and her true history is she had 17 siblings. So, you know, and I have a list of all those people when they were born and everything like that. So as I start to write, I feel like all of those siblings have to be in there, right? And I have a draft where she has 17 siblings and they get named at some point. It's terrible.
Yeah, you can't keep track of all
right?
of them.
You know,
yeah.
they serve no purpose. They just exist there. And, you know, in particular around writing historical fiction, it's about as much about what goes as what stays. You know, and so learning that, you know, make sure the when the chapter ends that you want to, you know, you want to turn the page and go to the next,
like
the next
cliffhanger,
chapter.
Right?
Yeah, that there's something driving it forward. That, you know, the idea that nothing should be in a sentence or in a paragraph or a page that doesn't need to be there. You know, all those kind of ideas.
So tell me a little bit about Mary, your main character, and what was true and what isn't. I mean, I think lively is a fair word. She's quite young, just out of college, just a fierce 19th century feminist. So how much of that did you create?
Well, so Mary Willis, the true story of Mary Willis is she went away to college at Alfred University in 1857. She was about 18 years old at the time. Well, you know, women did not go to college in 1858. And she went to Alfred University, which was only the second school in the country to take women.
Yeah.
And it was Alfred is about 30 miles from Seneca Falls, New York, which is the epicenter of feminism. It's so these things come together. This and Rochester, New York, is where Frederick Douglass is writing. So all of these radical ideas are floating in the ethos in Western New York at the time. So it's reasonable to you know, to assume this woman is, I mean, she's imbued with this kind of feminism. And so that's, I'm taking that as true, right? She goes to college, she comes home, 1858, and starts running an Underground Railroad station in her father's barn.
From the house that you ended up living in.
Yeah. Well, it was a barn at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And it was converted into a, house
later.
So
that part's true.
Yeah, all of that's true.
Did you find any writings of hers that might have given you a clue to her personality or the way she spoke?
No, that was all invented. Yeah, I have some her signature on some legal papers and stuff, but I've never found any writing. I'm convinced she married at one point and moved across the street from this house, and then she moved home because the other house burned, and I'm convinced that her stuff was there because a college educated woman would have kept papers and diaries and stuff at the time.
But it may have gotten burned in the fire.
I feel like it was burned, but I also, when I was a child, my parents came to, made a trade to have all the stuff cleared out of the house, and there's a guy who came took the stuff, and he had a diary in his hand, and he said, oh, look, I think that's a woman's hand, but people ask me if that was hers. I don't know. I fantasize that it was. But I was 5 years old. I couldn't even read it. I have no idea what it was. Could have been the previous owners.
So this must be, I have to imagine this happens with everyone who writes historical fiction, where the reader is sitting there going, wait, which part of this is true and which isn't? So were there actually Confederate secret agents having raids across the border?
Can you believe that? I mean, nobody talks about this. But there was the Confederate Secret Service was run by a guy named Jacob Thompson. There's a large monument to Jacob Thompson in downtown Oxford, Mississippi. He is and he became the basis for the Thompson family in all of Faulkner's books. One of Faulkner's books. He was implicated in 1865 in the John Wilkes Booth conspiracy, and had to flee the country. He lived over in England on $200,000 of mysteriously appeared hard cash for several years there before moving back to Oxford after supposedly clearing his name, but whether it was never really cleared. But there's this whole outlandish plot with Johnson's Island. Historically, this is true that he hired a guy named John Yates Beale, who was from right around Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. It was Virginia at the time; it hadn't split off. To go to Johnson's Island, which is where there's an island full of Confederate soldiers that were prisoners, to take them to Buffalo, to break them free, arm them, take them to Buffalo, and set them loose to open up a northern front. This is all documented plot. It fell apart, obviously.
Yeah, but, clearly.
Yeah. but these kind of, you know, we'd never think about the Canadians' influence in the Civil War, but it's quite an active border at the time.
So why is there such fodder for fiction coming out of the Civil War? Why do we seem to never tire of those stories?
Well, I think, aren't we fighting the Civil War essentially in some ways right now? I mean, we're not in the street, generally not in the streets with guns, but...
Well, they were in Charlottesville.
Yeah, they were in Charlottesville. Those battles still rage one way or the other. It's, you know, in my opinion, one of the tragedies of the Civil War, one of the wounds that has never been healed was, you know, with the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, you know, there was never a proper movement to to reconcile. You know, Johnson, you know, his
he was all about appeasement, yeah.
Yeah, it was never to, you know, never to get it right after that. And we've never healed from it.
So you had to create, well, let's go back to the town. I want to make sure I say it right. It's Town Line, New York.
Yes.
And this was settled by Germans. This is a real town.
Yes.
And let's talk about how this town came to secede, which was part of the whole beginnings of this novel, right?
Yes. So so first off, Town Line, New York, it's a hamlet. It's a crossroads. It has no legal standing. It is the line between Alden, New York, and Lancaster, New York.
It's literally a town line.
Yeah, it is. There's no mayor. There's no city council. There's no legal standing. There's no. They have a volunteer fire department, and up until a few years, the volunteer fire department, their shoulder patch said "Last of the Rebels," 1865 to 1946, which is incorrect because, of course, they actually seceded in 1861. But you know, there's a mythos going on here anyway, right? So, there's no contemporary documentation for the secession, but it's pretty clearly established that it happened. It was a vote of 100 to 23, you know, it's not quite clear what happened now
or why.
Yeah, so,
I mean, you imagine in, for your novel a lot of those motivations and what was happening in the town at the time, but historically, do we have an answer to that?
Well. So, Town Line, which is a pretty right wing place today and has been for a long time.
I would imagine if they had those patches on there, yeah.
They imagine an alignment with the Confederacy, and there's a claim that they sent seven of their local boys south to fight in the War of Northern or in the Army of Northern Virginia. There's no documentation for that. I've never seen a name of anybody that did it. It's a very hypothetical thing. And that kind of thing, that story kind of floated in 1946 when the reunification happened. But the real historical basis is, I mean, I've talked to descendants of people who have of people who were there. And largely the idea that I put out in the book is, I think, holds water.
The book also sort of forces us to contend with this idea of being an outsider. I mean, she's in the North, but she herself is very progressive. She went to a co-ed college, which at that time is very racy. And she's surrounded by this very conservative, as described even today, right-wing town. Is that something that you had experience with, or was that a sort of situation of being just kind of Cassandra screaming behind the walls of Troy, right? Was that a situation you had to fully imagine?
No, I'm half Asian, I'm half Chinese, and I grew up, I mean, there's not a minority, or there certainly wasn't besides me
in
Town Line when I was growing up. That kind of outsider status just felt absolutely natural to me. It wasn't hard to guess.
And the love story is imagined, is it not?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so you had to create, that wasn't her eventual husband, real eventual husband?
I don't know. How much should we spoil here?
So, don't spoil. Yeah, don't. Yeah. Don't tell that part. I don't want to lead you to any spoilers. But what I mean is, was there something in her eventual married relationship that you borrowed for the love story?
So I tried very hard to put Mary back down where I found her. I tried to pick her up historically. When the book starts, it's kind of where she is historically, and I tried to put her down right where she would have been at the time. But everything else is
in between.
You know,
it's
yeah,
all.
I take quite a few liberties in between. I'll grant you that. She ended up. Well, we won't spoil that.
No, don't spoil that.
But I will say, I think what you're asking about at root is perhaps that is Joe. The book opens with Joe, a fugitive slave who arrives at her farm, and he is a complete figment of my imagination.
So, what's your final decision on novel writing? You had to go through this whole process just to get this novel out.
I'm looking forward to having time. I've got a long book tour ahead of me, and I'm looking forward to getting back to sitting down and taking on the next
and
one.
And maybe doing the next, a second novel.
Yeah.
So you're a convert.
Yeah, I'm an absolute convert now. After you spend all that time figuring out how to do it, you don't just do it once.
Okay, so the next person that comes to you and pitches an idea, are you going
I will tell them what all my writer friends told me. He said, that's your story. You have to write it.
Author and Decatur Book Festival co-founder Darren Wong. His new novel is called The Hidden Light of Northern Fires, and it's out now. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today, but as always, we'd love to hear from you. Are you still without power from the storm? How would you rate the state's response to Irma? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. Happy.